Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today I am really happy to welcome back to the program my friend, James Howard Kunstler. Jim is a well-known author and social critic whose ideas have been extremely influential to myself and both the peak oil and sustainable living movements. His best-known works include The Long Emergency, one of the first books I came across in this genre, in which he argues that declining oil production will result in the reversal of modern industrialized society and compel Americans to return to smaller-scale, localized, semi-agrarian communities. He also wrote World Made by Hand and its sequel, The Witch of Hebron, which used fiction to entertainingly transport us into what that future narrative might look and, more importantly, feel like. More recently, he wrote Too Much Magic, Wishful Thinking, Technology, and the Fate of the Nation. And of course, he continues to write regularly at his excellent weekly blog found over at Kunstler.com. Jim, I'm really happy to have you back with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you, Chris.
Thanks. So let's start with your most recent book. Now, as I look at the S&P 500 sitting here over 1,500, I suspect many are beginning to think that wishful thinking works just fine. And in the realm of fracking the shale plays, that is now being heralded as the means for the U.S. to best Saudi Arabia at the oil game. Perhaps that technology is a form of useful magic. Put it all together, is not our fate really one of manifest destiny?
Well, you know, it's really funny to me that I wrote a book about wishful thinking just at a moment in American history when the wishful thinking in our culture ramped up to unprecedented levels. And the stories that were that actually began to come out in the year that Too Much Magic was published, which was 2012, it was published about 6 months ago, it absolutely coincided in lockstep with the stories about us becoming energy independent and becoming the next Saudi Arabia and having no problems and blue skies everywhere. And, you know, one of the net effects, of course, was that the nation was in such a mood of wishful euphoria that people really didn't want to read about wishful thinking. So that was, I think, to my disadvantage. But it's still going on. And, you know, the stories are pouring out. I think the larger question around that is the way that America is just lying to itself. And, you know, I wrote in The Long Emergency in 2005 that you could predict there was categorically a correlation between the distress that a society feels and the amount of delusional thinking that goes on. And I think that this has been borne out now. So nothing but blue skies ahead and everything's great. And don't worry, be happy. But, of course, in the background, you know, events are churning away. And, you know, we're going to be kind of disappointed about how that all works out.
You know, I keep trying to characterize this in a way to capture it appropriately because I understand the headlines that are coming out say one thing, but when I scratch at and look at the data, there's all this other data that says something entirely different. I don't exactly know how to square up, you know, improving state budgets and GDP that's apparently growing on the top line and record numbers of people landing on food stamp programs or things like that. And with, you know, oil is still pretty close to $100 a barrel in the U.S., but it's well over 100. It's at 115 on the world stage. And that doesn't comport at all with this notion that we are just about to enter a new era of absolute abundance in oil. And so I must imagine that there's some cognitive dissonance for a lot of people in this country right now.
Yeah, and the cognitive dissonance, and by cognitive dissonance, I think we mean the clash of ideas in our heads with reality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, history is very peculiar in the sense that sometimes cultures and societies go through very strange periods of their history. And we're in one of those now. And, you know, I characterize this as the sort of the great period of America lying to itself. And the way that it's really carried out as a practical matter is that accounting fraud is now the basic mechanism for running most of the important things in American life. Accounting fraud is now the basis for banking and finance. and it's certainly the basis for government, and certainly for its fiscal role. So I think what you're seeing is a kind of deformity of the consensus. And of course, the most striking feature of our current times is this inability of the country to construct a coherent story about what's happening to us, and therefore the inability to construct a story about what we might do about it.
Speaking of accounting fraud, then, I noticed that I've been tracking the shale gas and shale oil stories, but the shale gas story is particularly interesting. And you would think that by the time the president of the United States is using information and says something like there's 100 years of natural gas left, that would have gone through some relatively heavy filtering, or at least some fact-checking, or it would have somehow gone through a process where it had been vetted on
That's
some level.
More to the point, Chris, and forgive me for interrupting, but you got to wonder, like, what is going through Stephen Chu's head? And I'm speaking of the Secretary of Energy who just announced his resignation a few days ago.
Yep.
You know, how could he vet that statement?
And what's interesting there is that to pull that claim and use that claim, you have to just rely on industry pronouncements of what they have. And I don't mean to cast aspersions on an entire industry, but I do know something about oil and mining and gold mines, and there's a tendency for the operators of said resources and production facilities to maybe exaggerate just a little bit. My personal handy number is whatever the industry says, I usually divide by two. And sure enough, a big report just came out where Texas looked at the Barnett Shale, which is the longest running shale play that we happen to have. There's 16,000 wells. There's enough data that they can actually calculate the trajectory of these wells. And guess what? It's about half what the industry had been claiming they were going to get is going to come out of those wells. It's nothing to sneeze at. But the difference between having, say, 30 years of natural gas and 100 years is all the difference in the world, because if we're going to use that gas to do something useful with it, like, I don't know, rebuild our infrastructure or invigorate our waterways for transport or do something, we're going to use that energy to perform some useful work to get us to a different future than the one we're inhabiting. Instead, we have this narrative that says we have so much, it's so many years in the future, no rationally sane politician should ever have to think about it. In fact, let's just lose 25% of the energy in that natural gas and compress it because we think we can sell it to the Japanese for a dollar profit. What is going on there? How can this still be happening?
I think it's pretty simple, actually. There's a kind of master wish behind all the other sub-wishes in the battery of wishful thinking. And the master wish is for us to be able to drive to Walmart forever. And, you know, it has a lot to do with the investments that we've already made in American society, and I'm speaking of the physical infrastructure of daily life in America, the way life is laid out, the urban subdivisions and the strip malls and the way you have to get around and the highways and everything. And so, because we can't imagine letting go of all those investments, and frankly, it is hard to see how we might do that, it's not the kind of thing you're going to transition out of necessarily. It's probably something that's going to be just subject to failure. But I think the stress of imagining that and being fearful of it produces the master wish to drive to Walmart forever. And then that is adumbrated by the information about shale gas and shale oil and kind of incorporated into the story, which is a false story, that these resources will allow us to drive to Walmart forever. And I think that's pretty much how it works.
It seems to me that what you're saying is that it's our prior investments that are shaping our future decisions. And one possible reflection of that I thought was an extreme example, but it came up multiple times in the past 3 months, where I noted different columnists were arguing that we had to boost our population growth numbers because we have these entitlement programs that are going to break if we don't. And I thought that's a really strange reason to bring people into the planet. You know, that's as a rationale. We need to.
Yeah, it's very similar to the rationale that we should continue our immigration policies because we need more potential home buyers. Right?
But it's offered, and not even tongue in cheek. It's a straight up argument. It's a rationale that many people hold. It's interesting.
Well, it isn't a whole lot different from the rationale that we should just keep on creating imaginary money to compensate and offset for the fact that we are not accumulating real wealth in a real productive economy anymore. So, you know, all of these things are tied to the cognitive dissonance, as you said, you know, the clash between what is really happening and what we wish for. And what is really happening in reality in this moment in history is a comprehensive contraction in economic activity, because there's a connection between the energy inputs into an economy and a culture and the your ability to accumulate wealth of the kind that we're used to, produced by industrial activity. And that's coming to an end. And there's kind of no way around it. Now, there are plenty of things we can do. And, you know, the terminology that we use, I think, affects the way we deal with this. For example, using the word growth incessantly is, I think, very counterproductive, rather than using the term activity. Because, you know, you can have a lot of activity of the kind that we need without necessarily having the kind of industrial growth that we've experienced in the past. For example, we have a tremendous amount of work to do in this country to reform and downscale and relocalize and reorganize the major activities of American life. You know, whether it's agriculture, which is going to have to get smaller and more local and finer and be done by more human beings than machines.
Mm-hmm.
And be done by more human beings than energy slaves,
mm-hmm.
you know, or commerce, which has got to be reorganized from the Walmart level of 12,000-mile supply lines and warehouses on wheels, you know, depending on all of the tractor-trailer trucks running incessantly around the interstate highway system. So that's a huge task that faces us. You know, we basically have to rebuild the Main Street economies. And not just, you know, in an intellectual or conceptual way, but actually in the bricks and mortar. We've got to go in there and, you know, refurbish our downtowns. We've got to change the transportation system, because the airline industry is failing, and the happy motoring industry or way of life, you know, will be coming to an end, probably sooner rather than later. As far as the airlines go, you know, that is an activity with a very short time horizon. The announcement came over the web just this morning that American Airlines and U.S. Air have finally found a way to merge. And, you know, that means that now all of the major airlines have accomplished a major merger. But it also means that a lot of people are going to start being fired, you know, as they consolidate the activities of these two airlines. And routes will be eliminated, and there will be fewer flights between both airlines, you know. It'll be one airline now, but with fewer flights to fewer places. And a lot of the secondary and tertiary markets, like, you know, Appleton, Wisconsin, or Knoxville, Tennessee, you know, they will have fewer flights to those places. So that's all happening, and there is no mention whatsoever of rebuilding the conventional railroad system in the USA. We've had this conversation before, and I'm not going to drag it out. But, you know, it's a narcissistic, techno-narcissistic fantasy to think that we're going to build a high-speed rail system in America. We're not going to do it. We're too broke. The money's not there. The capital formation is impaired. We may build or start to build a line or two between San Francisco or Sacramento and L.A., but we may never even finish those. But we desperately need to rebuild a conventional railroad system. People would be delighted to go from New York to Chicago at 90 miles an hour if the trains ran on time and arrived on time and left from stations that were not like public toilets. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about that. So we're facing the imminent decline and probable eventual demise of commercial aviation as we know it. We're in this big continental-sized nation. And we're not thinking about another way to get around. So this whole range of tasks, you know, rebuilding Main Street commerce, rebuilding agriculture and reforming agriculture, rebuilding transportation, you know, those are three things right there that are immense tasks. We don't have time to wring our hands. We don't have time for blame games, okay? But we got to get down to work and and accomplish these things, and we're not doing any of them.
Well, let's talk about how we set priorities then. I guess a useful starting point here in this conversation might be the State of the Union address, which just happened a couple days ago. And so, you know, I know that's largely a political sort of a venue, and there's a lot of politics going on, and I'm not entering this conversation with a partisan slant or bone in my body. And yet, I think the collective narrative is expressed there on some level, and at least it gives us something to react to. And I noticed that Obama did say, you know, together we've cleared away the rubble of the crisis. I think he said we're getting stronger, you know, it's giving us a sense of direction. But somewhere in that speech, he mentioned that, you know, there's 70,000 structurally deficient bridges across the country. He mentioned that, and that we're going to fix all of these. And by the way, it's not going to cost a dime more, so it's not a deficit situation. Isn't this sort of an example of what you're talking about? We have 70,000 deficient bridges. We need to fix those, but we want to do it without costing a dime. How do we square that circle?
Well, I think more to the point, the entire State of the Union message really is about a campaign to sustain the unsustainable, you know, which means really to a campaign to stay exactly where we are and at all costs try to maintain the systems that are running the way they're running now. And an unwillingness to face the necessary imperatives that reality is now bringing down on us. I had a good hard look at the State of the Union address, and there were a number of things that struck me about it. I say this as a registered Democrat who voted for Obama twice because the alternative seemed to me to be worse than Obama. But I do think that, you know, the federal government cannot pretend to compensate for a real economy by just introducing government programs to offset the contraction that we're under. And the more that it tries to do this, probably the more incompetent and ineffectual it's going to be. And, you know, it will end up being in a kind of never-ending Hurricane Katrina type of nation where nothing really works and that the interference and interventions and manipulations of the federal government, especially in money matters, is going to end up just being very destructive. The idea that we're reviving manufacturing in this country, you know, that to me is not quite credible because it mostly says to me these are jobs for robots.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the way manufacturing is done at the moment really means automating the factories as much as possible and having as few people working in them as possible. So I don't really see that as being something that's going to be meaningful. The idea that rising house prices are a good thing, which, you know, Obama made a big deal of, why is that? Is it so that people can use their house as an ATM machine to get into greater debt again? You know, after the debacle of the early 2000s when, you know, households went into debt catastrophically. So that's not a very good idea. And is it a good idea to make houses more expensive when young people don't have jobs and don't have incomes and can't form households themselves? So, you know, the housing sector is just being jacked and gamed by destructive federal government policies and Federal Reserve policies for low interest rates and banking shenanigans that are keeping foreclosed properties off the market. And so, you know, what you're seeing there is just a racket. Then there's the immigration thing. We've already spoken about that, but, you know, we actually need to curtail immigration at all levels, including well-educated people from foreign lands. We don't have enough jobs for people with master's and doctoral degrees in America. So the idea that we need to let in more people from other lands with advanced degrees is insane. And I'd remind listeners that there were times in American history when we made rational decisions to curtail immigration for a while. Okay, the 1920s, for example. After 5 or 6 decades of very robust immigration, we turned around and said, you know, maybe it's time to sort of turn off the faucet and just stay where we are for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good decision. And we might have to make it again. Because there are a lot of people, there are, you know, demographic movements all over the world right now as regions of the world become less favorable to live in for one reason or another. And America cannot absorb them all. An awful lot of them are going to want to come to America. And, you know, I'm speaking of whether it's, you know, a third world place in great distress like Mali, or a nation like France, which is an advanced nation putting a lot of pressure on its citizens, you know, to get out with its tax policies. So we just don't need that. And, you know, you come to the conclusion that President Obama is kind of a genial fellow and, you know, a nice guy, but kind of sadly clueless and increasingly tiresome.
He certainly seems to be a very, very strong proponent of the idea that we're going to preserve the status quo. And I wouldn't expect anything less from anybody who managed to rise through the national political machine to get to the presidential level. Of course, that's their job. And you're articulating this idea that our status quo is now beginning to sort of feed upon itself. It's going through some sort of, as John Michael Greer put it, catabolic collapse, right? It, as the body starts to eat itself when it runs out of other forms of fuel. And the thing that I find distressing or upsetting in all this is that I can clearly see that we could chart a very different future for ourselves where we had a realistic conversation about what's possible, what's not possible, just at the economic level. Let me take some complexities around energy off the table if that confuses, you know, the average politician. The idea that we're going to return our economy to how it used to be functioning is an idea that we're going to return to a state where we're going to grow our debts at roughly twice the rate of the underlying economy. And we're going to continue to do that forever. And anybody who's ever had an income in a credit card can tell you that's not possible. It's just, it's a math problem. But somehow we have all of our faith now reinvested in the Federal Reserve. They are omnipotent. We have complete faith that they are going to walk this absolutely razor-thin edge where on one side they blow it and they create too much money, too many claims against too few goods, and there's this, you know, sort of destruction of the currency through an inflationary event. And on the other side of this knife edge, there's a deflationary collapse. And we've largely collectively at this point, at least if we trust the mainstream media, said, we think the Fed has this in hand. They've got it. And all you have to do is crack open the minutes from the 2007 Fed, which is the most recent sets that we have. They had no idea that the housing bubble was bad or how bad it could be or that there was any issues growing in subprime, even though there were people like you and me and anybody else who could rub two thoughts together saying, we have a problem here. So how do you remain engaged in the narrative when it's that far off the reservation?
You know, it comes back to the unfortunate condition of a nation that is so frightened of the consequences of what it has been doing that it cannot really face reality. And so it just spins one story after another. And the Federal Reserve part of the story is just another untruth that we can create imaginary money forever, and that takes the place of capital formation. I think Jim Rickards put it pretty well the other day when, you know, he said that this kind of monetary policy exists in what he referred to as a critical state dynamic. In other words, you can't just dial up free money and then dial down free money when you seem to be getting into an inflationary problem. It's just not that, you know, the control, the toggle just doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, in fact, is that things go critical, because it is a critical state dynamic. And what's been going on is that we've been trying to compensate for the lack of capital formation with this imaginary money. And by capital formation, I mean the ability to accumulate real wealth from real wealth-producing activity. And, you know, creating credit card money on a national level is not real wealth-producing activity. I think the closer we get to this point of criticality, the more delusional we're liable to become about it. So, you know, this is just sort of a subset of the larger state, that larger dynamic of the more distressed the society gets, the more delusional it gets.
Well, that's on the large scale. Certainly, as we troll the media, there's a story being spun, and it's getting a little strident, I find. It's in its ability to overlook certain things.
It's hilarious. I mean, one hilarious thing about it is that everybody is kicking back, marveling at the rise of the Dow and the S&P.
Uh-huh.
When, you know, it's quite clear what's going on.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's just a lot of phony baloney, not real money, you know, credit, basically. A credit card is being stuck into the ATM of the of the stock indexes, and you know, and jacking them up.
Yeah, well, that's what thin air money does. And one of the larger mistakes that Greenspan made that Bernanke is perpetuating is this idea that as long as asset prices rise, we're actually all getting wealthy. They call it the wealth effect, as if it were a real thing. And but they distinguish that if commodities are rising, they go, well, that might be inflationary. But when assets are rising, that's virtuous. And they're the same process. It's the exact same dynamic. And what I don't think they understand is that there has to be some balance, of course. This is, it, they should understand it because it's written into the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. The mandate, the actual mandate that the Fed has. By the way, the Fed does not have any legal mandate written down in any document that says they're responsible for unemployment levels or the general nature of the economy or other, or fiscal matters or any of that stuff. Their job is to make sure that money and credit aggregates remain in rough proportion to the economy. Period. They're not there to direct the economy. They're not there to assure that the S&P is rising constantly. They're not there to make sure house prices are at the right level. I'm putting up air quotes, the right level. They're not, that's not any of their job, but somehow, you know, mission creep and, you know, organizations do what they do. So they are now responsible for everything. And
well, of course, also the wishes of political figures to use a mechanism of the Federal Reserve to try to manipulate reality. And that can only go so far. I think that the issue that you and I are kind of treading around without maybe articulating it is the amazing fact that there has not been an enormous financial accident in the last several years, because there are so many circles of things traveling at high velocity at the giant scale, you know, whether it's the movement of capital around the globe electronically or the size of the bailouts that are being extended to institutions, or the gross nature of these manipulations and interventions. It is an amazing thing that some terrible financial accident hasn't occurred. But I, you know, I think that gets back to Rickard's view of criticality, that, you know, these are threshold events. These are things that happen in inflection points. There's a term, I think, in the study of avalanches called the Lahar effect. And the Lahar, I think, or maybe that's geology, the movement of, you know, landslides and avalanches and things, is that you have to account for what is the difference between the moment when all that stuff was stuck on the mountainside and the moment after that when it all fell down. And, you know, maybe it's the difference is one single snowflake or the movement of one grain of sand. But we've sort of set ourselves up for a very bad moment in which people are going to lose confidence in a kind of catastrophic way in their currencies and in the institutions that manage them. And this is the, you know, the tremendous danger of accounting fraud, of using accounting fraud as the basis for operations in banking, is that you reach a point of criticality when all of a sudden, guess what? You have a worldwide bank run of one form or another. And that becomes kind of a cascading catastrophic event. And I think the amazing thing is that nothing like that's happened. The only thing, the only little tremor that happened was that 1,000-point Dow drop that was called the flash crash, I think, in 2010.
Yep.
And, you know, it's just, it is just an amazing thing that nothing else has occurred.
Well, it is amazing. I think if we were going to break this into two camps of thought, I know that there are some people who are thinking, look, because nothing bad has happened in the last few years, we're going to take that as an idea that the Fed has played out the clock well, the underlying risks have been mitigated in some way. That was certainly, you know, President Obama said it, right? In the State of the Union. Together we have cleared away the rubble of the crisis.
Absolutely. I think you're quite right.
And the other camp of thought that goes on the other side of that is my, which I think you're articulating, mine is, oh, no, 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 no. All we did was we are now storing that potential energy up into a larger future event of some form. You can delay, but you can't completely defer these sorts of things.
And, you know, I think it's easier to do in something like a financial system because you're not dealing so much with, you know, hard concrete things so much as abstractions. And what you're doing is manipulating abstractions, and you can keep a lot of abstract balls in the air for a while. But eventually, of course, you know, you are left with reality, and you are left with what happens on the ground. And eventually abstract concepts are not a replacement for that. You know, one of the major lessons of the last 20 years that has not been learned in advanced societies, and in particular in America, is the idea that the virtual is not an adequate replacement for the authentic. And, you know, a virtual economy of computer money created out of thin air is not a replacement for actually activity on the ground that works for real people, that gives them real roles in society, that gives them real fulfillment and an income and an ability to run a community and run institutions successfully at a level and a scale that they are capable of operating at. And, you know, so we're making the mistake of thinking that all of these, you know, it's kind of, in a way, I mean, it literally is too much magic. It's, you know, it's like the old viziers of the Arabian Nights, you know, thinking that they can just invoke magical auguries and have things happen and make things right. And we're going to be disappointed about that.
And in that vacuum of that gap, that cognitive dissonance between reality on one side, which is sending signals, all you have to do is open up a couple of pages deep into the newspaper and you find reality staring at you, whether that's bluefin tuna now at 1% of their former population densities, whether it's the fact that all the old trees in the world seem to be dying, the fact that aquifers are being depleted in places that are extremely populated and there's no plan B for what happens when that water runs mm-hmm. out, on and on and on and on. And so as I travel around, I note that in that vacuum, there are people stepping into it saying, I don't know exactly what to do, but I have to do something. And the most exciting progress I see is at the individual and community levels. I'm wondering what you're seeing.
Well, I see it around here a lot, and the region that I live in is close to you. It is, you know, we're in different states. I'm in upstate New York, you're over in Massachusetts. But I think both of us are in old, mixed landscapes of former industrial activity and a kind of rebirth of agriculture. I'm certainly seeing it around here. We have very good soil in Washington County, New York. The dairy industry went through a long decline, and as it's ending, young people are actually moving up here and starting small farming operations. Now, the commercial economies of the towns around here have not caught up with that because they are still dominated by the chain stores, and for the moment, there's no way for them around that. Mm-hmm. It's very hard, for example, for the little downtown of the old factory village where I live to revive because a quarter of a mile down the road is a Kmart, you know, which has taken over all of the dry goods commerce that used to be downtown. I don't think that the American public realizes how quickly that can change and how quickly the dynamic of the chain store economy can implode. You know, because it depends on these 12,000-mile supply lines and the warehouse on wheels and just-in-time delivery of all the stuff. You know, we are eventually, I think, going to rebuild the fine-grained local commercial networks that will support an agricultural economy. So far, we're only seeing the beginning of the agriculture module start to reform.
I'm interested in the big stores, because I think we have there's a situation developing I think we could keep our eyes on, because it'll give us a model of how this might unfold. And that's Argentina. They just, what was it, last week or the week before, implemented a 3-month price freeze at the store levels, and they have a bunch of Costcos and Walmarts down there. So I'm trying to imagine what you do if you're a big national, international company like a Walmart, and you are being forced by fiat to accept pretty punishing losses. That's the nature. You can't, you know, price controls are just a way of forcing the store owners to eat the losses that the government has enforced through its printing policies. And so we might get to see what happens if you have these big international companies that just say can't operate, is one thing they might say, and they just up and leave. And all of a sudden, you will go from relatively well-supplied, middle-class consumer abundance to paucity really quickly, I think, potentially.
I think that's an excellent example. And we would probably agree that the whole notion of price controls is generally a self-defeating kind of policy. But mm-hmm. what you're describing really is in the folder of unintended consequences.
Yep.
And, you know, unintended consequences is one of the reasons that large federal governments become so ineffectual and impotent and actually destructive. I think it's characteristic, really, of the time that we're living in, that there simply is no sense of consequence. And that's exactly what you get, you know, when you have a Federal Reserve that's out of control and a public that is filled with technological, narcissistic visions of Santa Claus delivering rescue remedies on demand. And so there's no sense, there's no general sense that when you do things, bad things can happen. And I think what I'm afraid of at the really gut level about where we're going, and I've expressed this in my novels, is that the American people are going to be so disappointed by the broken promises of technology and government and of the idea of progress generally, that they're going to become, you know, they're going to retreat into superstition and the supernatural, and they're going to reject science, and they're going to reject reality. And that's really, I think, something that we're really not prepared for, to live in a society that is, you know, dominated by superstition and supernatural thinking. But it could get that bad if we keep on playing, you know, fast and loose with reality and with the consequences of the choices that we make.
It's interesting then, because we already have examples that we could look at here in the United States, whether it's Detroit, which is showing a failure of industry that happened, or we could look at the Ninth Ward in New Orleans is still pretty much a disaster zone. Or looking at how we've just turned a blind eye to, I think, a lot of the victims in areas that are pretty devastated by Sandy. Or we could look at what's happening in Harrisburg with all the sinkholes and the town's too broke to even, you know, pour sand into them as a stopgap measure. And or what's happening in Camden, New Jersey. It doesn't matter. We have all these areas which show that this is what decline looks like. And my read of that is that, generally speaking, we just don't look at them. That's our response. It's if that was a developmental stage, I know exactly how old my children are. As long as you don't look at something, it's not there. And so it's hard to really feel like we're squaring up to the circumstances as they are at this point. And I have a personal sense of, how would I put this, that I've been working. My mission is to actually reveal these things and to help get the narrative moving up the curve, not down the curve. And I feel like that at this point we are further away from getting the story right than when I started, and I don't like that feeling.
I agree with you. And you know, those of us who like to think that we're in the business of trying to create a reality adjustment in America, I think have had a rather hard row to hoe in the last several years. And, you know, I do. When I published a book about wishful thinking at a time in the arc of the story when wishful thinking was the most popular thing going. And, you know, being what it is, people didn't want to hear about it. I think we've entered a time when events rather than personalities are in the driver's seat. And I think that we are going to see movement in these events, and we're going to see what I would call consequence in a major way start to infect the reality zone of the world that we live in. And, you know, I just hope it doesn't get too rough and ready, and I hope it doesn't lead to conflict and war and, you know, a lot of really nasty internal division in the USA.
I hear that. Let me ask you this then. What anything in particular you're keeping your eye on is, do you have any, let me put it this way. Do you have any favorite horses in this race for the events that might precipitate a shift? You're looking at Europe, Japan, U.S., budget sequestration. What's sort of capturing your fancy at this point?
When I started writing about these issues, I thought that the energy story would be the lead in the story. And to some extent, it's still high up in the story pyramid. But really, I think what's happened is that the repercussions and consequences of the energy story in finance and banking and the management of money, and by that I mean the management of the accumulated wealth of our societies, has become a much bigger story. And now what we're seeing is that the mismanagement of accumulated wealth has become so grotesque that we're really turning around and finding ourselves broke at every level. You know, whether it's the French government or the U.S. or the state of Indiana or you know, you name it, or your household, or, you know, anybody, that the state of mismanagement has been so gross that we've turned around, found out that we're broke, and we're going to make the really unhappy discovery that we don't even have the money to continue the exploration and production operations to get the energy that we need to keep on having this economy that we're, you know, that we're wedded to, and thus unable to find our way into the next economy or another economy or something that will allow the human race to remain civilized. And at the bottom of a lot of my hopes and dreams is that we do manage to remain civilized. You know, there's a lot to be said for civilization. I know people have made arguments against it and have blamed it for, you know, a lot of people think that we should just revert to becoming hunters and gatherers. But it's probably a good thing that we have Mozart and root canal and that we sleep more than 3 inches above the ground.
Well, I'll tell you, the reason that I spend my life trying to turn this narrative around is not because I want to go back and live in a simpler time. That's not my motivation. Honestly, my motivation is I would love to preserve all of the wonderful things that we do have that are truly wonderful. I think being able to get a root canal and penicillin along with it is a wonderful thing compared to the alternative. And what I see is my country, my nation squandering its wealth, squandering its opportunities, time being the most important one. But just the thought of that we're going to export our natural gas is just an extraordinary squandering. What I want is what I used to have in my time working at companies, which is that if you worked for a good company, there was good leadership, and you always had a strategy, which was, and this strategy only has two things to it, two arms. One arm says, where are we going? And the other one says, how are we going to get there? It's your vision and a sense of your resources. And guess what? You never have infinite resources, so what you do is you prioritize. And to me, that's my primary critique of the State of the Union address was it was really short on giving a clear sense of where we're going, except to the same place. We're trying to get back to where we just were. That's our direction. And secondarily, there was no sense of resource limitations. It's like, no, we'll do it all and it won't cost a dime. And so that is just so far off the mark in terms of being, I think, actionable, measurable, realistic. It's wishful thinking. It's too much magic.
Well, we see nations get into trouble, and I like to read about history, and I spent a lot of time when I was writing Too Much Magic reading about the rise of Hitler and the Nazis and the state of mind of Germany in the 1920s and 30s, because it's really remains one of the great mysteries of history, of why the best educated nation in Europe went crazy in the 1930s, you know, literally went crazy. And I'm afraid that the United States is capable of becoming even more crazy than Nazi Germany was in the 1930s, because we're starting from a kind of a much lower cultural level. You know, when you look around and you see the actual level of education of people, you take a freshman from, you know, any college class, and they probably can't find Argentina on a map of the world. And, you see all the tattooed, pierced people sitting around the convenience store. And you kind of wonder about what our country is capable of. And, you know, I come to the conclusion that our country is capable of some pretty terrible behavior under the wrong circumstances. And it frightens me. It's one of the reasons I've made the choices in life that I have to move to a small town far away from where a lot of people are.
Well, you know, as we're waiting for the jury to come in on whatever the verdict is on this next stage of our history, I find that my joy, my passion, my vitality comes from applying myself at my homestead here. I love growing things. I love planting things. It's my way of saying what I can control at least gives me some measure that I'm doing things with purpose that are fulfilling. There's quality involved. It's beautiful. Those are the things that I do. And in large measure, that's a reaction to the idea that I no longer feel that I can really, there's nothing I can do on the political stage. There's nothing I can do except wait in some respects for certain things to transpire. Even as I recognize that this is probably one of the most important times in history to continue to articulate what needs to be said. I truly believe that truth goes out of fashion, but it never entirely disappears. And It's pretty clear to me that your voice, my voice, all the other voices that are really trying to say, hold on, stop, there's some other things we need to talk about and think about. It's probably one of the most important and fulfilling jobs that needs doing, but in the day-to-day part of it, it's a mystery how to be really effective at this sometimes.
I've had a very vivid sense for at least a decade or more of the importance of having to just personally lead a purposeful life.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggled to get to the place where I could do that, where I could manage my own time and be my own boss and get a little piece of my own land to do my own gardening and grow my own fruit trees.
Well, absolutely, we're in agreement about leading a life of purpose, and I'm really glad you did find a way to engineer your life in a way that makes sense for you. And if I could, I'm going to invite myself up to come see your place sometime. I'd really like to.
Okay, please, and do come in the spring when you can actually see what's going on here underneath the snow.
Yeah, I know better than to visit somebody's place in the New England region in February or even March.
My apple trees and pear trees have only been in the ground for a year. They did grow a lot in 1 year.
It's fun.
They're not
to watch
that impressive. They're not as impressive as yours are, certainly.
And those are 3 years old. You're going to love them. You're going to love watching. They're, it's one of my favorite things to watch those trees grow. And they grow so much faster than I thought. It's wonderful.
And I'm getting a couple of chestnuts this year. There's no guarantee. They're the American chestnuts that are supposedly now blight resistant. And I hear various stories about how well that has worked, but I'm looking very forward to watching them grow over the next decade, which I plan to be here for. And it'll be great for you to come up and give me some of your ideas about what I'm doing here.
Well, I would love to. And we've been talking with Jim Kunstler, of course. You can find more about Jim over at Kunstler.com. You, of course, any of his books, very easy to find on Amazon. I would suggest that Too Much Magic and Wishful Thinking, Technology, the Fate of the Nation is an important book to read, especially when there is a lot of magic thinking going on, maybe more so. So, Jim, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure.